Recorded live at Podcast One, this is Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. And now here's your host, Daniel Bain.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this breaking news report. Daniel Beatty is the new host of Unscripted. That's right, you heard me. Daniel Beatty is the new host of Unscripted. People across the world are tuning in to witness what many are calling some deep shit. Ain't he an actor, singer, writer, activist? Why he hosting a podcast? Inquiring minds want to know. Now let's get some more live on-the-spot feedback. I was like, okay. Warren Beatty gonna do a podcast. I was like, all right. I've been liking him since Dick Tracy. No, Daniel Beatty with one T. Oh, okay, Daniel Day-Lewis. He can act. No, Daniel Beatty. Who's he? Well, I, for one, am intrigued. I'm excited to see where this goes.
It's appalling. I mean, it's a setback. In 2018, this is the last thing we need. Who gave him a podcast?
When I first heard the news, I was in stunned silence. Hallelujah! I'll be tuning in right after church.
My name Clarissa, and it's my boyfriend Peter. Hi, everybody, hi. I mean, I guess I never thought about Daniel Beatty. Peter, he sometimes be talking about him, but I don't pay him no attention. Oh, okay, wait, though. We did read about him in school. He does that poetry. Knock, knock. See, I told you, Clarissa. Shut up, Peter. Dang.
I am from Ghana, West Africa. Brother Daniel, we will be tuning in. Wakanda forever.
Who is this man? How will this story unfold? Stay tuned for further details. This is Daniel Beatty, the man of many voices, and what you just heard are several characters from my play Emergency that I've had the joy of performing at the Geffen Playhouse many times. It is my sincere pleasure to be your new host for Unscripted. My goal with this show is to explore the courage, the craft, the personal stories, why we as artists do what we do, and also the unique role artists have to play in this particular moment in our world. Let's face it, these are challenging times, and I believe artists have a unique role to play. Artists have a capacity to integrate mind, heart, and soul. We play on a daily basis in the realms of imagination, creativity, communication, and we are adept at finding possibility, even in the most dismal circumstances. And if you're feeling like me, you can use a little possibility and hope. So, thank you for tuning in to Unscripted. As you fall in love with what we're doing, and you will, please spread the word. And let's enjoy this safe space of conversation, contemplation, creativity, and courage. I used alliteration, I did. And now for our guest.
Hey, podcast listener, this is Rob Cisternino. I'm the Rob, and Rob has a podcast, and the new season of Survivor is just getting started, and we've got new episodes for you 5 days a week. Join us for interviews with your favorite past Survivor players and this season's losers right after they get their torch snubbed. Listen free to Rob Has a Podcast, exclusively available on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and the Podcast One app. And if you like the show, why not share it with a friend or leave us a rating and review on iTunes?
He's an actor, director, producer, and political activist. He began his acting career on stage, spending 7 seasons at Williamstown Theater Festival. He first caught our attention on the big screen as the villain Carl in the box office smash Ghost. You may know him best as President Fitzgerald Grant on Scandal, and never one to slack, he's also directed 9 episodes of said show and a host of others. No scandal here. He's been married to his wife, Jane, since 1987, and they have 2 beautiful daughters. Yes, this Tarzan truly found his Jane, having voiced the title character of the animated feature. He's Hollywood royalty whose family puts the G in MGM and has garnered Best Director and Best Film credits for The Last Kiss, Someone Like You, Conviction with Hilary Swank. And he's a political activist who works with the Innocence Project and speaks boldly for women's equality. Tony Goldwyn, it is my pleasure and honor to have you as a guest on Unscripted.
Thanks, Daniel. I'm so happy to be here. Yeah. And you made my bio sound really, really impressive. I wanted to stand and applaud for myself.
that's totally allowed here. So, Scandal, 7 seasons.
Yeah.
Like, that show, I'm a fan, and the ability to be fast-paced entertainment and then also talk about hot topics and current events and even social, political issues was pretty amazing. What was it like to do that show, and how does it feel to be wrapped?
Yeah, the whole thing has just been such a gift for a lot of reasons. We're right now finishing up. This is our last week of filming.
Oh, my goodness.
And in fact, I don't want to get any spoilers, but I just did my last scene with one of the characters last night. And tomorrow, I think, is actually my last day of filming, and we finish on Friday night for good.
Oh,
so it's a very emotional week, you know, for us. This business is so crazy. Like, I never would have expected that in my 50s I would sort of have a role drop in my lap that was sort of a, you know, this kind of sexual, romantic, controversial, really rich, complicated character, and would have such mainstream appeal as Scandal. And where the writing would be so consistently rich and challenging. I had never wanted to commit to a television series before as an actor, because when I first started out many years ago, if you worked in television, you really couldn't work in movies.
Right.
There was a real wall up between the two. So when I started out in the 80s, I just would take any work I could get. And I started working in the theater where I really did have a passion for. And then the first jobs I got that weren't on stage were doing guest shots and, you know, guest starring roles in TV. And that sort of meant I couldn't do movies. And I remembered my agent was more of a TV agent. I was sort of like, well, he's a TV actor. So I got a couple of small parts in movies, but it was hard. And until I did Ghost, which was 6 years into my career, I had to fight for every movie audition I could get.
Wow.
Then once I busted in.
You're like, I'm going to stay
and
here.
And had a big success. Right. I was like, I can't go back. So all through the 90s, it was just like, You couldn't. It was considered kind of career suicide to do that. I did one pilot in the mid 90s with my friend Tom Fontana, who's such a great.
I worked
TV
with Tom.
Did you work with Tom?
I did 22 weeks with Tom as a TV writer for a show we were developing.
Oh, great! Well, Tom's
Netflix.
The
he's
greatest.
Incredible.
And we've known each other forever. And that was the one person I thought, well, I don't care about the rules. I'm gonna do this with Tom.
Yeah.
And then it ended up not getting picked up. But anyway, my point is. That all started to change in the early 2000s, you know, really with HBO changed the game. And then with The Sopranos and Tom's show Oz really changed things. And The Sopranos big time. And then you had Mad Men, you know, and then the whole world changed.
Yes.
And those barriers came down. But in that time, I'd become a director. So I thought, well, if I do a series, I won't be able to direct a movie. You know, it just is too constraining. And I raised my kids on the East Coast. And I thought... it just was a lot of constraints. So I felt I had more freedom. So anyway, that's all to say that 7 years ago, I thought, well, the world has changed. My kids are almost grown up. One was in college. The other one was almost in college. And I thought, now I have the flexibility to give it a shot. And then boom, I get this call from Shonda going, you want to play the president? And I could not have planned it. You know, you think so much as an actor. Well, this is how it's supposed to go. And I think it's important to have goals and to go after one's dream. But, you know, the fact that we think we can control outcomes.
Yes.
You can't.
Right.
So I just feel just super blessed. And it's been the best thing about Scandal are the people, the company that we've – that Shonda and her partner Betsy Beers put together. It's an incredible group of actors, and the whole crew and the whole culture of that is a really, really beautiful thing that is the most difficult thing to separate from.
Absolutely. I can actually feel your emotion around it. And of course, I mean, it becomes a family working mm-hmm. together for that long. Something else about the show, the acting is incredible. And there's something about being able to create stakes that are high enough that the actors can be as passionate and committed as the moments that are happening in that show mm-hmm. and it be totally believable on TV. And I feel like that's a space that Scandal has carved as well. And I know Shonda likes actors who've had, you know, some experience in the theater as well.
You have to, it almost is, maybe not everyone has been on Scandalous, but it's almost a requirement for the way she writes.
Right.
What you said about stakes is so correct.
Yeah.
You know, she set us in this fantastical world of an alternate reality White House, which seems today to pale sometimes in comparison to the actual,
right.
You know, White House. But, you know, the reason, one of the reasons that works so well, and it was very apparent to us immediately mm-hmm. that when you're in those positions, mm-hmm. everything is life and death.
Yes.
The stakes, when you're president of the United States,
right.
when you are, you know, the head of the NSA, when you are a fixer in Washington dealing with the worst day of people's lives, you know, the stakes are always tremendous. So as an actor, that's just so fun because
right.
what Shonda's so gifted at is we have these, you know, then she tends to focus on the interpersonal relationships, which are just like yours and mine. And
right.
in our own lives, in our own narcissistic lives, right. everything is super high stakes.
Always.
You know, I get enraged at the grocery store.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes,
like,
part of being human.
I can't find, you know, where's the oatmeal? Oh my God, I'm going to get killed when I get home. I didn't bring the oatmeal. You know, but then you know, if you have life and death and war and scandal and mm-hmm. Reputation and all of those things in our world, it's just, it's great. And that's what, you know, I don't know. She just uses it so deftly and mm-hmm. uses it as a way to also talk about the things that she wants to talk about
right.
from a social, political perspective, but in a completely entertaining, not preachy way, I think,
absolutely.
Is her gift. She's really extraordinary about that.
Absolutely. Definitely. One of the things, and we'll use this conversation to veer a little bit, you know, is that she's also ushered in a bigger platform for women as showrunners and executive producers. And we're in a really particular moment in our country when women are having some long overdue platform to advocate for their space in society. And there's the Time's Up and Me Too. And you've been very vocal talking about, you know, working, being employed by a woman, working with dynamic women in your career, having a dynamic professional wife and daughters. Like, how do you feel about this moment and what role do you feel men in particular have to play?
I think it's a tremendous opportunity this moment,
yeah.
you know. I mean, while it's tragic, you know, a lot of the behavior that's been exposed,
mm-hmm.
it's also a tremendous gift to us as a society.
Right.
It's a tremendous opportunity that we cannot squander. And I think that is as much the responsibility of men as it is women.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a Time's Up meeting that Shonda had invited me to for men.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the statistics that the person who led the meeting, who was an expert in the field, said that really shocked me is he said it in a positive way. He said, look, 85% of men are not abusers, predators, harassers. And I was like, wait a minute. That
yeah.
means 15%
are. Right.
So that lays a lot of responsibility on us both to be conscious of our own behavior and to challenge ourselves and to ask the questions of ourselves in subtle ways of how do we interact with half the population, both in the workplace, in our relationships, as parents, as friends, as, you know, all of it. And then how are we – this is the more difficult and maybe more important or equally important thing. How are we silently complicit
right.
in that abuse, harassment, you know, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
By being kind of – tacitly in, you know, what's the famous phrase, you know, by
saying nothing.
By saying nothing, I'm doing something.
Something, yeah, exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
So to call it out, to figure out how to call it out, to be active allies.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Yeah, you said something very important in sort of the social work, justice work I do. I did a project in Boston, and I interviewed a lot of different social justice leaders in the different boroughs because there's a lot of racial division there, as there are in a lot of our cities. And some of the people I interviewed were actually, you know, white people who were working in urban centers to do advocacy work. And they both said the same thing to me, which was that it's not my responsibility to speak at the march of a group of people who may be a group of black people or LGBTQI, if I'm not that. It's my responsibility in my own homogeneous community when someone says something that's racist or someone says something that's homophobic or someone says something that's sexist to speak up and speak to that community. And I hear that understanding too, like how do we as men hold each other accountable, you know, and how do we be transparent about the ways in which our male privilege shows up that we're not always aware of, so we can expand our consciousness.
I think it's really right, and I also feel that it's inseparable from our consciousness about the racial divide in this country.
Right.
For any disadvantaged community like the LGBTQ community, it's an approach toward the world. And, you know, I've done it. I'm guilty of it myself when I have been – I had an experience last June. My daughter graduated from college, and she and her friends had a little graduation party with the parents, and it was a really nice lunch. Mm-hmm. And one of the kids' grandparents was chatting with me. He was an old 90-year-old man, and we were talking, and he made the most shocking racist remark to me, and I was rendered speechless.
Mm-hmm.
And I was an out-of-body experience,
right,
what he said to me, as if I agreed with it. As if,
right,
he prefaced, I will not repeat his comment because it was so offensive, but he prefaced it by saying, now look, I'm just a guy who says it the way it is.
Wow.
And I was like, uh-oh, here it comes. And he said something, and I thought, I was shocked at how I was unable to speak out, and I was ashamed at it. But I thought, A, I was so shocked by his comment, I didn't know what to say. Then I thought, oh, do I make a scene at my daughter's graduation party and make everybody uncomfortable? Her friend's old grandpa, who's just an old dotty old racist.
Right.
Great term. And I still don't know how I would have said it other than just walking away. Or I know that there was some deft, articulate way of putting that man in his place, but I was unable to do it, and I'm ashamed that I was.
Yeah. You're just saying something profound to me, because the isms, racism, sexism, they're violent towards all of us.
That's
even
right.
If we're not necessarily, you know, the person that's directly being attacked, you know, and that's an interesting question. It reminded me of an experience I had at the 33 Club at Disney. For who people don't know, it's this very sort of exclusive club where people can go and have drinks. And I was there with some friends, and we were a diverse group, and there was a table that was all white and a little bit older, and a man kept sending us drinks. And so we went over and started having a conversation, and he was, you know, ex-military and had a very interesting story about how he met his wife. And, you know, we're just laughing, and it comes out in the conversation that he's a Trump supporter. And I almost stopped, being, because things are so violent and urgent now, just got up, but I stopped and I said, this person has been engaging with me, you know, on a human level, being very kind to me. So I said to him, I said, when you said that, my first impulse was to get up, but I'm dealing with the fact that you as a human being are treating me as a human being. Like, why do you support Trump? You know, and I said, and I asked that because a lot of what he stands for is in direct opposition to my very existence. And he paused for a minute and he looked at me like, do you really want to know, or is this a setup to attack me? And his story, which I won't go too much in detail because I really want to, you know, learn as much as I can about you, was that he had been in Vietnam and he had seen children hold a gun to him and kill him, and he had to kill, and it was a very traumatizing experience. And he came back, and he described as hippie liberal spit in his face and called him a killer. And he then positioned himself in a world where his perception of what it means to be liberal and liberal politics are not good for him. And I tell that a little bit long story to say that you talk a lot about always being shocked when people say things are black or white, you know, in a quote I found, in that, you know, often life lives in the shades of gray. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to sort of this moment, like, why is it important for us to embrace the shades of gray?
You first of all, you answered the question for me that I didn't. So thank you. I know now what I should have said to him. I felt this impulse that I was supposed to shut him down and to judge him and criticize him for his racist remark.
Yeah.
And that's what I've been struggling with. But now I realize that the productive thing to have said to him is to engage him in a conversation. Because his comment that he made was directly, oh God, I was, I put it this way, I was at this weekend in D.C. at the African American Museum, and there was a phrase used that white people used to describe male and female slaves. And it was exactly what the phrase he used to describe black football players. And it's what shocked me. And now that you say that, tell your story, I realize I could have had an effect on him by just talking to him about that. And going, you use that phrase, you say the way it is, but what that really is this, is that really how you don't really, do you really perceive, like, how do you see the world in that way? Like, what's that about? And engaged in a very difficult conversation. But I was so quick to feel judgmental of him. Not that that's not reprehensible, well, but,
right.
But if I could have raised his consciousness and learned something myself, that's what you're talking about. That is really profound what you just said. And I, you know, every story that I tell, I find as an actor, why I've, you know, like playing villains sometimes is because it's so interesting to not judge them and to get inside them and go, where's the human side? Where's the other side? What's the other side of the story? Even though an audience may watch and go, I hate that guy. But my job is to bring the humanity to it. Every time, particularly as a director, it's always going, there's no good guys and bad guys. There's no right and wrong. I'm always fascinated with moral ambiguity. It's why I've find the character of Fitz and Scandal, you know, for the most part, for so much of him has been really interesting to me because there's all this moral ambiguity that Shonda's playing with. You know, you can write a character off as one thing, but then you're like, oh, but I love them. Like I'm rooting for them, but wait, they did this terrible thing. Well, that's just human.
Absolutely.
So it does extend, you know, our job as storytellers, I think, is very related to our job as people.
Absolutely. I think that's so profound. And that, for me, when this opportunity to do this came, that's exactly why. Because I really believe that artists have a crucial role to play right now because of exactly what you described. We live in the realm of imagination. Like, any good character is built on contradiction, right? We have our objective, the things we're going on for, and we have our obstacles, you know, and that's human nature. And I think that that space of imagination, that space of what might be possible, even when it seems so dismal, is something that we as creative beings live in that realm all the time.
Yeah.
And so it's like, how do we create the space?
And it's the whole, you know, our whole objective as storytellers, the whole experience of listening, watching, hearing, observing stories is a communal one. It's a one of connection and comparing lives and getting in someone else's point of view and seeing life from a different. That's why we're, you know, from, you know, earliest, you know, for thousands of years, that's been the draw to have that connection. I want to share one other story on this subject, which is away from, it's more political than, you know, this moment we're in because it's so polarized. And as progressives, we feel the need to speak out or to act. I know I do, and it's why I'm but I also find I need to be very careful. It's very easy to just attack.
Right.
And to vilify the opposition. Because in many ways, sometimes we're so offended by it, particularly when it's overtly racist or, you know, has those implications, the sort of dog whistle aspect of it. And I had an experience. One of my colleagues on Scandal, who works on the crew, had been in at the Las Vegas shooting.
Oh, wow.
And had had a terrifying, traumatic experience. And when he came back to work, I went right up to him, gave him a hug, and we talked about it, and he told me, and it was really bad. And then we started to talk, and he felt, similarly to the man you told me about in your story, he was very, very upset about the gun control thing. And he's a conservative, and he has had guns his whole life. And, you know, he was – I was amazed that he immediately went – he was so upset that liberals were suddenly attacking – you know, he felt attacked by liberals, that they were using this as a political opportunity. And we, you know, he got really pretty heated up about it. He said, look, Tony, I know we see things differently, but this is how I feel. And I was like, okay, I hear you. But where the conversation went is I said, you know, here's what I don't understand. I said, I don't understand – that while I understand, you know, the Second Amendment is the Second Amendment, but I've never seen a single Democratic proposal or piece of legislation that ever talked about dismantling the Second Amendment.
Right.
I've never seen it, and I've studied them. All I have seen are, you know, and supporter were was not about taking people's guns away, but were about gun safety. Locks on guns, combinations, you know, personalizing, you know, fingerprints on guns, background checks. You know, yes, I don't understand why we need weapons of war. You know,
yeah,
like those things.
Homes,
and, he said, well, look, listen to me, man. He said, I completely support gun safety. All of my guns, all my kids knew how to take apart a rifle at, you know, 8 years old. And he said, but they are all... You know, I think guns should be legal. And he said, I think background checks, I'm all for them. He said, I don't think anyone who has a mental illness should have be access to a gun. I don't think anybody who takes even a narcotic medication should be allowed to have a gun. He went to all this list of things.
So just, like,
and
same.
I was like, well, we pretty much agree on this. We might disagree on the how of it. But it was a very it was a fascinating conversation to me. Because when we got away from the heated political rhetoric and the polarization and we got to the mechanics of it, there really wasn't a lot of daylight between our different points. There might have been some. But I think in our society right now especially, it's become so polarized that all we see is the difference. And all we see is we feel attacked by the other side. And it made me so sad because this dude is a great guy. He's such a lovely, wonderful, affectionate, warm professional. He's a good dude. And, you know, you know, he has a family, man, and all the things. I just really respect him a lot. And we happen to have different political views, which is what our country's about. You know, that tension between conservative and liberal is a really important tension in our it's why one of the reasons our country functions, you know, when it's functioning at its best. So that's why I think we have to be very careful, particularly those of us with a platform, not to just stridently attack because it's too easy. And then we're in the echo chamber and that can be really fun, but it's not much different than just gossip.
I completely agree. And, you know, everything is an energy, right? And so if we meet conflict at the energy of conflict, all we create is more conflict. But what I hear you talking about is – honestly, which is what I think my highest value is love, right? And you had, you might not even necessarily use a word that dramatic, but you had love for this individual.
No, I would, absolutely. It's a very important word.
A very important word, right.
The most important
the
word.
The most important word. And then that created a space that rather than dismiss or attack, that you wanted to engage and have conversation. And that is the biggest... call right now. And I remember when Obama was doing one of his last, if it was not his last public speech, his call to us was have the difficult conversations. Mm-hmm. Like, how do we have the courage to communicate with each other? And I think that that's the moment. And it's hard when there's so much anger. That one, I want to connect this again to this metaphor that we're having in terms of being creative beings and the creativity we need for this moment. About your work as a director, you once said, the more decisions you make, the better statistically your odds of success are. And what you've also learned is that it doesn't matter. Anything can be fixed. When you're directing, you can agonize, but you can't indulge. Stuff has to happen. So in terms of what we're talking about, how do we begin to fix where we are? I mean, we suggested the listening to each other. And what kind of decisions do we need to start making to increase our odds for success?
I think it's all about connection and starting a conversation and realizing that, you know, there is a minority of people mm-hmm. who are deeply committed to anger and hatred.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that most people, I would say more than 85%,
right,
are kind of want the same things.
Mm-hmm.
And if they feel angry and hateful, it's because they feel somehow attacked themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you have people say, well, I'm not racist. I got nothing against that guy, but
– right.
They're saying that guy scares me, or that guy's going to hurt me, or that guy's going to attack me, or I need to protect my family, or there's certain assumptions that are made mm-hmm. why this is not safe,
right.
You know, or like you said, you know, the Vietnam veteran who felt attacked and, you know, that was deeply
traumatized.
Deeply scarred him, traumatized him.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's like having the courage to have these conversations so that this is back, circling back to our original point about feminism
mm-hmm.
And as our role as men mm-hmm. is to start to engage that conversation
right.
as opposed to being like, dude, that's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
That implies I'm better than you. So even if you win the argument or something, you're not going to change that person. You're going to shift.
Right.
But if you have the conversation of like, whoa, what are we trying to achieve here? Here's the impact on, here's what I'm hearing. Is that where you're at? Like,
right.
What are we trying to do? What are we to have the conversation?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the connection. And that's the same thing as bringing it to storytelling is, you know, I'm really careful as a filmmaker
mm-hmm.
not to be polemic about something. When I made Conviction, it was about, this is a story within our criminal justice system that happened so
yes.
that somebody goes, oh my God, that, you know, that guy spent 18 years in prison for a crime he did not commit.
Absolutely.
Are there other stories like that? Let me take a look.
Absolutely. I love that because the specificity of narrative and the specificity of storytelling allows us to really see and get present to the heart, desires, journeys of people we may not know. I mean, literally for me as a black man, I literally tried to create layered portrayals, not only of black people, but those who are disenfranchised in general, because it's like, if you can truly see us, then you might be less likely to kill us.
Well, I found Chapter and Verse, your film that you did with Jamal Joseph, that your performance is so brilliant. And that it has exactly that thing. I felt that I was led into a world and an experience of a black man in Harlem that while I was familiar with the construct, it was done in such a personal way that I felt privileged to have been let in there as a, you know, a person who grew up white and privileged male in this society to see this very, you know, noble character who's really just trying to grow. I don't know. That was really a perfect example of something that I thought was not, was just very, very personal. And,
right.
You know, I walked away thinking about that experience in a way that I hadn't before. And that's the goal, you know?
Yeah, I appreciate that. And, you know, I appreciate your time with us here. I've been a fan on screen and I'm excited we get to have lunch now.
Yeah.
But, you know, you've played a lot of different types of characters and a lot of really complex characters. But I just would like to feedback and share with the listeners who may not have the opportunity to meet you in person the huge humanity that you also carry with you when you enter a space. I could feel it instantly. It's shown up in this conversation. So thank you for that. And thank you for your work as an actor, director, producer, and activist, and for using your platform for good.
Well, thank you, Daniel. So good to talk to you.
Likewise. And with that, this is your host of Unscripted, Daniel Beatty. Until next week, take care of yourselves. And remember that we're here for each other. It's not always the big actions that change the world. It's how we show up for each other day by day. Our lives are unscripted, ever-evolving creativity. And moment by moment, we get to choose the role we play.
Thanks for listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Be sure to download new episodes every Wednesday on the Podcast One app, at podcastone.com, or on Apple Podcasts. And don't forget to rate, review, and share the show on Apple Podcasts.